Our show today is sponsored by Beast Brands, makers of premium hair and body wash, lotions, and skincare products, like Wash for Everyone, which won a Men's Health Grooming Award. Beast Wash for Everyone is a lightly scented head-to-toe cleanser formulated for human beasts of all kinds that can replace your shampoo, face cleanser, and body wash. It's perfect for sensitive skin and features aloe, shea butter, ginseng, and orange. Here's what I love about Beast products. They smell amazing, green and herbal, sometimes with a eucalyptus tingle or a light citrusy spritz, depending on the product, but they're never overwhelming or perfumey or chemical smelling. That's because they smell like the natural botanicals they're made from. It's that simple. Their formulas are vegan, cruelty-free, and produced in the USA, and they're always looking for ways to be more eco-friendly. Their new Beast Bottle is an infinitely reusable aluminum pump bottle that holds a 6-month supply of one of their all-in-one body washes, so you can cut down on plastic waste and save money compared to loading up your shower with a bunch of different products. Plus, your shower looks clean and minimalist because you just have this one sleek, gorgeous bottle. You can find them on Instagram at Tame the Beast, as well as simply at Beast. Go to Beast.com and use code BROBIBLE to get 25% off your next order. That's GETBEAST.com. And the code is BROBIBLE for 25% off.
I fought a good fight. I finished my football race. And after 18 years, it's time.
Basketball players, we're really supposed to shut up and dribble, but I'm glad we do a little bit more than that.
Eventually, every ball will go flat, but that doesn't mean that your life will flatline. What will you do when the game is over?
All right. Coming in red hot off our Matthew McConaughey episode. So what better way to start episode 67 better than a quote from Mr. McConaughey and Dazed and Confused himself? What is in himself? All right. We got another big one ahead for you guys. Another triple header. Three incredible guests coming up. Our first guest of the episode is one of my favorite actors and a guy who has starred in some of my all-time favorite movies, from the Royal Tenenbaums to Old School to now a new sports classic inspirational movie. It's called 12 Mighty Orphans. I am talking about Luke Wilson, brilliant actor. He's got this new movie out called 12 Mighty Orphans, opening nationwide on Friday, June 18th. It's in Texas movie theaters now. Just an incredibly fascinating and inspirational tale about football during the Great Depression. Luke plays a legendary coach that is able to build a football team out of 12 unlikely candidates to create a national story. It's a movie that's going to captivate the public and I think be an instantaneous sports classic. And it takes place in his hometown of Dallas, Texas. I think you guys are going to just love this interview, but also love the movie. We're talking all about his career, his new movie, growing up with Owen, and of course, their relationship with Wes Anderson and more. Our second guest is a man that if you watch morning television, you will know very well. Today's show anchor, Craig Melvin. He has a brand new book out and an incredible book, by the way. It's called Pops, Learning to Be a Son and a Father. It's available now in bookstores everywhere. It's a fascinating book where Craig details the lack of relationship that he had with his father, but how they were able to mend fences and become as close as ever. And as someone who had a very similar situation to his father, I absolutely love this chat. And our final interview is one of the hottest bands in music, Grammy Award winners, a throwback to what rock and roll used to be. I'm talking, of course, about Greta Van Fleet. I'm chatting with Jake and Sam from the group. They have a brand new album called The Battle at Garden's Gate. So without further ado, let's kick this off. Our first chat is with Mr. Luke Wilson. Enjoy. Luke Wilson, congrats on the brand new movie, 12 Mighty Orphans. What a story, man. Must have been a blast to tell, especially from your hometown.
Thank you, Arthur. Yeah, I appreciate that. Nice to see you. And yeah, it was really fun to get to. I'm from Dallas and we shot in Fort Worth, which is right down the road. So yeah, it's always really fun to shoot back in Texas, but I hadn't gotten the chance to do it for a long time. And my mom still lives in Dallas. So it was great to be home.
Dallas. And of course your beginning is synonymous because you, Wes, and Owen came up with Bottle Rocket. That was the beginning. That was where you shot it. So to be able to return, did it bring back memories of the very beginning?
Yeah, it really did. And especially because, and it really hit me hard on 12 Mighty Orphans, because I was around all these boys that were on the team. And I was like, this is what we had to have been like on Bottle Rocket. They were like really nice and really curious, but clearly kind of a little overwhelmed and like learning about everything, but really like they weren't out of place. Like they had that kind of confidence that you can have when you're kind of young and you don't know any better. You don't know enough to think like, wow, I'm really in over my head here. And it also just made me think back to, yeah, shooting Bottle Rocket and how nice James Caan was to us and how nice the crew was to us, because yeah, we didn't know what we were doing. And that's what I loved about being around, you know, these boys on the team in 12 Mighty Orphans. They were like such funny, nice kids, and also just really hardworking and never complaining about the cold or, you know, being outside shooting and not having shoes on and stuff like that.
I actually really enjoyed the movie. I didn't know what to expect. I had no idea about this story. I loved watching it. It obviously captured a nation during an insane time, the Great Depression, way before any of our times. So when you get to tell a story like this that you may have not been familiar with in a book you may have not been familiar with, how do you dig in? How do you learn about it?
Yeah, I mean, I oddly enough, I somehow missed the book and it was a bestseller. But when I signed on to do the movie, I had friends back in Texas that were like, yeah, I love the book. I read it. And then friends of my parents that were older, they'd read the book and were also familiar with the story. And to me, I haven't gotten the chance to play that many real life characters. So doing research is really fun for me to get to read about somebody or look at pictures. And it was nice with Rusty Russell because, you know, he was a real character, but I didn't have that pressure of like, you're not playing somebody like JFK where you know what he looks like, you know what he sounds like. So you're trying to live up to other people's expectations. I could kind of put my own stamp on him and my own take on it. And that's what I kind of tried to do.
Your story and your brother's story, and obviously Wes's story, it's so interconnected, but it's become legendary through the business. But the incredible thing is, obviously, Wes has gone on to become one of the most prolific directors in the business, your brother, and you became massive movie stars. But you never really wanted it. You were kind of this accidental movie star. So to now look back and obviously making movies like this, but to have made some of the classics that you made, is it pretty crazy to think back on how it's all played out?
It really is. I mean, to me, it's a shock that we ever even got Bottle Rocket made, because, you know, it was such a strange offbeat movie. But yeah, it was a classic thing of having, you know, Owen and Wes, two really smart, hardworking guys, and then a lot of luck to get somehow partnered up with James L. Brooks and Polly Platt, who was his partner at the time. Yeah, we just got really lucky. But I just feel lucky that we got that made, and then to still be working in this day and age. To have something like 12 Mighty Orphans come along where, yeah, it's so different from Bottle Rocket. And, you know, I went from playing, you know, a kid to now I'm playing an old Texas coach. And again, it was all hitting me so hard when we were making 12 Mighty Orphans, just to be in Texas, and we were making it at the same time we'd made Bottle Rocket. So I would really go outside and be on the set and like get those smells of fall. And it was really like really kind of washing over me, the nostalgia.
Obviously, unless you've lived in Texas, no one can understand what football means to that state. It's as big as any religion. So growing up, and I know you played football up through high school, what was the football culture like growing up?
Yeah, I mean, we went to this boys' school, so and football was popular, but it wasn't, you know, it didn't have the intensity that, like, you know, Friday Night Lights and the Midland Odessa. And even there were bigger schools in Dallas that were these kind of powerhouses that were almost like you know, college teams where they had AstroTurf fields and they had these big stadiums and like stadium lights. But yeah, football in Texas at the time and still was pretty incredible what a big part of your life it was, even if you weren't playing it, like the Cowboys and their games on Sunday and the playoffs and Tom Landry and Roger Staubach and then Troy Aikman and Jimmy Johnson. I mean, it's just a big part of your life. And, you know, the newspaper, the local news, what people are talking about, you know, what people are wearing. It's a real fabric of the city. And, you know, I've seen it happen. I think maybe when I went to Philly, that's been maybe the biggest sports town I've ever been to, maybe besides Dallas, where, you know, you run into, you know, there would be like a lot of women at sports bars, where like other towns, like sports bars, it's just going to be guys. Like in Philly, it was like, wow, there are women here in these sports bars. Like they know more than the men about the Phillies.
So by the way, I'm originally from Philly and okay. I grew up, I don't like any of the Philly teams, by the way, but they hate you guys. I mean, the Cowboys don't even wear a jersey because you're not walking out of that stadium.
That's funny because I had that happen when I was in Philly, and it's like, I felt bad saying, like, you guys really weren't even that much on our radar. I mean, we were kind of more concerned with the Redskins and the Steelers. Like, at least for me, I always kind of thought you guys had cool uniforms. I never felt threatened by you guys. Like, I didn't know you guys hated us so much.
You obviously, I mean, you think about your IMDb. Some of the movies you've been in are timeless classic. I'm obviously old school, one of the great comedies of all time. Tenenbaums, legendary. But when Luke Wilson's walking down the street, what are you getting recognized for? What are you getting stopped with the one-liners? Like, what's happening?
It's like Idiocracy a lot. The Mike Judge movie, Blue Streak with Martin Lawrence, Tenenbaums, old school. Like, yeah, there are those kind of, you know, movies that kind of hit the zeitgeist somehow. And Legally Blonde, you know, with like there are moms now that were little girls when Legally Blonde came out, and they now show the movie to their kids. So yeah, it is funny, but it's kind of a wide range of movies, but yeah, a lot of comedies in there.
Obviously Bottle Rocket was your first, but was there another experience out of all those movies that kind of just touched you in a very unique way?
I mean, the Royal Tenenbaums was incredible just because to go from making Bottle Rocket in Dallas, and then we made Rushmore, Wes and Owen's next movie in Houston, to then all of a sudden we were in Manhattan and they were making the Tenenbaums, and there was Gene Hackman and Bill Murray and Angelica Houston, Danny Glover and Gwyneth Paltrow, where all of a sudden it just kind of exploded. And like the wardrobe was more complicated, and the production design was more precise. So yeah, that was a real turning point, the Tenenbaums. And but then there have just been different movies. Like, I have to say, with 12 Mighty Orphans, it's one of those ones where I just thank God that it came along, because I just love doing it. And also realized, like, you know, how fun it was to play a real character as opposed to kind of some version of yourself or some character where, you know, you can kind of sound the same and look the same and wear the clothes that you might wear. For me, playing Rusty Russell, you know, I would put on that wardrobe and try and like, okay, I got to get a handle on that accent. And I can't let it slip today. And I'm as proud of this movie as I am of anything I've ever done.
I was actually going to segue to the accent, so you did it perfectly for me. That Texas accent is heavy in this movie, but then obviously throughout other roles in your career, you're able to subside it. When you got to Hollywood, was it difficult to get rid of the Texas accent?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely, I can remember, you know, this is after I might have been in Hollywood for like, you know, 8 or 10 years. I was doing they had me doing a voice audition for like an Apple commercial. And I did a couple of takes, and the director was like, from the booth, he was like, yeah, that was great. Can we try one just without the Southern accent? And I was like, that was the one without the Southern accent. So that's about as flat as I can make it. But no, I think we definitely, I've never known about, you know, I don't have a good ear for my own accent, but like my dad had a thick Boston accent, which he never lost, even though like me and Owen were, and Andrew were all raised in Texas. So in between, you know, the accents we grew up around and our dad's accent, I feel like, you know, things got kind of, you know, there's some weird accent there. And then, you know, of course I've heard people imitating my brother and myself. And then I'll go back to Texas and I'll hear somebody's Texas accent. I'll be like, oh, okay, well, that sounds like somebody's imitation of me or Owen. But with the accent for 12 Mighty Orphans, you know, I'd started working on the dialogue, you know, learning these coaching and teaching scenes, you know, like a month out, just because I wanted to have them down well. And so I just started kind of doing this accent on my own, and I hadn't thought about it much, but I was just kind of leaning into these Texas accents that I grew up around. And then, you know, Ty Roberts, the director, never mentioned it to me when we were rehearsing. Then I just remember after the first day thinking like, wow, I'm locked into this thing. Like, we ain't coming back to reshoot, you know, 12 hours that I did today in a teaching in a classroom. Like, this is what I'm doing for the rest of the movie. But then it was great. And it was the kind of thing, like in a movie like this, you do really rely on the wardrobe, and you do rely on the locations and the buildings and the rooms that you're in, as well as you do on the other actors and the people in the scenes with you.
So before I let you go, Luke, one of the reasons that I started this series was to talk to successful people like you about how they're able to achieve success in their careers. What do you do to continue to elevate in your career and be at the top of your game?
Well, I mean, one good thing about the business I'm in is it's always changing. And so you really kind of have to be willing to kind of go with the flow and kind of learn new things. And I definitely see older actors that don't seem to manage to go with the flow. And then there are people like Martin Sheen, who in 12 Mighty Orphans, where, you know, he really is able to kind of seamlessly kind of keep moving through these different iterations of the business. And for me, it really is just kind of staying open-minded and just kind of be willing to learn new things. Because, yeah, I mean, even being 49, I find myself talking about the old days or the way they used to do things. And I'll think, gosh, if I'm starting to think like that at 49, what am I going to be like at 69? But, yeah, I think, and there are those people, though, that you see, that the people that seem like they're happy and successful, they have a real curiosity and a real willingness to learn new things and try new things.
Luke, you're awesome. You're one of my favorites, man. And you made some really great movies. And 12 Mighty Orphans is one of them. I tremendously enjoyed the story and what you guys put together. So congratulations.
Arthur, thanks a ton.
All right, folks. That was, of course, Luke Wilson. Make sure to check out his brand new movie, 12 Mighty Orphans. It's in Texas movie theaters now and opens nationwide on Friday, June 18th. Our next guest is one of the most beloved and well-known personalities in morning television. An amazing story to make it to the very top of morning television. Craig Melvin became a mainstay on the Today Show. And now with his new book, he's showing us a totally different side of himself and his life. The book is called Pops, Learning to Be a Son and a Father. It's available now in bookstores. And as mentioned before, it really dives into Craig and his father and the lack of relationship that they had growing up, but how they were, again, able to mend fences. And it's a truly inspirational learning lesson that never give up on your family, never give up on those that you love. And in the end, you can have that fairy tale ending. So here he is, Today Show anchor, Craig Melvin.
All right. We are thrilled to have on The Endless Hustle today Show and MSNBC journalist and author of the new book, pops, my father, our journey, and what I'm still learning about being a dad, Mr. Craig Melvin. Thanks for making the time, Craig.
Matt, thank you. Thanks for having me. Good to see you guys. I'm a fan.
Excellent, man. You know, let's start off with the book. Can you talk about its genesis and why you focused on the subject of family instead of a more kind of career-centric approach, as one may expect?
Well, yeah, I haven't been doing it long enough to write a professional memoir. So I didn't want to go that route. And at the start of the pandemic, it was cheaper than therapy. I mean, I like a lot of sons, I have a complicated relationship with my dad. It has gotten exponentially better. And during I guess it was late last year, there was a publishing house. They sort of approached me about writing this book about dads, because I do a series for the Today Show called Dad's Got This. And I didn't honestly think it was book worthy. And then I was talking to a guy, and we were talking about our relationships with our fathers. And then he said, well, you know, that's actually probably a story worth telling. So we started going back and forth, and I wanted to make sure I weaved in the stories of some of the really cool dads I've met along the way. But the bulk of the book is about my father, who grew up not knowing who his father was for much of the early part of his life. He was born in prison, and he has dealt with addictions throughout his life. First booze, then gambling, then cigarettes. But it's a story about redemption and renewal, and how a guy who's almost 70 years old manages to get all those monkeys off his back using sheer willpower. So it's a story with a happy ending. But I'd also like to think it's pretty funny. I mean, there's some parts in the book that I write about that are pretty laugh out loud funny. A lot of it's about my childhood in South Carolina, where I spent a lot of my time helping my dad on various projects under the hood of his 1973 Pontiac Le Mans, or digging up the sewer line. That we did that one summer. And from the time I was 6 or 7 to the time I was 16 or 17, I never got a promotion. I was like still holding the flashlight or passing a socket wrench. He never thought. So, there's part of it's just funny anecdotes that I think a lot of dads can relate to. So it's also, Matt, not just a book for dads. It's a book for anyone that has had someone in their life who has struggled mightily with something, whether it's an addiction, whether it's an illness. And it's a book about how people get through that, how families get through that. But again, going back to my first point, at the end of the day, it'd be great if someone bought the book. It'd be nice. But at the end of the day, I wrote the book for my dad, and I wrote the book because I didn't want to spend all that money on therapy over the past year. It was a great escape during a pandemic.
Craig, before we got started, I was complimenting you and the rest of the cast at the Today Show. I've just had the privilege of chatting with all of you guys many times over the years. We're all getting old together, which is great. Ah. And I always say, one of the nicest, if not the nicest, casts on television. As we were going through just this crazy time, and we're still obviously going through it, but hopefully coming out on the other end now with COVID, you guys were a beacon of light to everybody who had to essentially sit at home and live in this horrible reality we were in. What was some of the incredible feedback that you would receive from viewers as you were able to bring this light into their homes?
It's a good question. You know, Arthur, I did not fully appreciate how much the show was a part of people's lives until the start of the pandemic. I don't know if that makes sense, but I mean, I always knew, and obviously the Today Show has been around for 70 years. It's one of the longest running news programs in the history of television. I was familiar with the history, with the institution that is America's favorite morning news program. I did not know how much of a part of people's routines we had become over the years. And all of a sudden, the pandemic hits. And everyone's, sort of being forced to stay inside. You can't do the kind of newscast the kind of show that we do, you can't do it just from here. That doesn't work. So, you know, early on a decision was made that we were going to go into the studio. We would split the show. So Hoda and I were in Studio 1A. Savannah was at her house. And part of the reason was because, especially early on, if one of us got COVID, we didn't want the entire cast getting taken out. So we sort of had to divide and conquer. But for several months, I would go into Studio 1A, and it was me and Hoda Kotb and one guy behind like one camera. And there was like one security guy, you know, no hair, no makeup, no wardrobe. There were like six people in the control room. And early on, it was really sad. And there were a couple of times where I became emotional on the air or on the ride home from the studio, because so much of what we do on the show revolves around interaction, you know, cooking segments and lifestyle segments and steals and deals and celebrity interviews and all this stuff. And like that, it's gone. And we're forced to do it via remote by and large. And then we realized quickly after the pandemic started, yes, we had to obviously report on the gloom and doom that was, you know, the early stages of the pandemic, especially, and the death tolls and just the sickness and the uncertainty around what was causing the virus and the symptoms, all that stuff. We'd had to do that. But we also saw a tremendous opportunity to tell stories about the first responders and about the teachers who had, in the span of 2 weeks, figured out how to teach all of our kids virtually. We figured out how we could celebrate the folks that we had long been taking like for granted in this country. So we started devoting a lot of our time on the show to celebrating the people who were saving us, or celebrating the people who were delivering our goods. You know, who knew that the UPS guy and the FedEx guy and the postal, who knew that these people like would become like everyday heroes? So we got to tell those stories. So that was cool. I remember one of my favorite live shots we did was from the hospital there in Harlem. And these nurses who had just, they'd been getting hammered for months, and they had seen all this sickness and sadness and death and loss. And it was taking a toll on them, personally. It was just taking this toll on their spirits and their souls. And we had this idea. I've never had any good ideas. The producers have all the good ideas, but someone had this great idea of going down to the hospital and just celebrating the nurses. And we went down we went over to the hospital in Harlem, and we spent a morning just celebrating those nurses, but nurses all over the country. And it was hard not to get emotional.
Craig, awesome. I got to say, we've had a few guests on here where it's just, you just give them the floor. We had Neil deGrasse Tyson, we've had Jalen Rose, and it's just, you let them talk. I think you're one of those people now where it's just like, this makes our job so much easier because you're just more eloquent than anything that we can conjure up.
Well, Matt, you're kind. The problem is, and Liz knows this, and I guess I'm faking it reasonably well, I hate this. I don't like, you know, when you ask questions for a living, you don't like answering questions.
Yeah.
But thanks.
Yeah. So one of your most watched clips on YouTube is your interview with Michael Jordan after he opened his health clinic in 2019. You were sipping tequila with MJ. How was that experience for you? And what did you learn about Michael that you may not have known?
I'll tell you how the experience was so awesome. I've already insisted to my wife that it be included in my obituary. I've selected the picture that I want her to use. You know, it's funny because you guys, you know this, like there are certain interviews that you want and you just persist and you persist and you persist. I had been hounding Michael Jordan for a sit down. This is not an exaggeration. It's probably the better part of 5 years. to the point where his people just stopped responding. I'm sure they thought I was a stalker. And then out of the blue one day, I get a call, and we had a mutual friend, and they were like, hey, Mike wants to know if you want to sit down and talk about this health clinic that he's starting in North Carolina.
Awesome.
And I said to the person on the other end, I won't use the exact language I used, but I thought that it was a joke. I thought that they were punking me because they knew how much time I had spent pursuing Michael Jordan. So it was right at the beginning of The Last Dance. Like The Last Dance was about to come out in a few months. And I remember, because you prep for interviews, like, you know, you prepare meticulously for, and the bigger the interview, the more you prepare typically. And so I'd been preparing for, you know, like weeks. And then all of a sudden, like MJ shows up, and I am reduced to my 10-year-old self. And I'm like, hey, oh man, Space Jam was great. You remember, it wasn't Space Jam one, you know, and like all my notes are like out of the window, and I managed to pull it together for the interview. But you know, it's funny because you know this, like the best stuff you typically get from someone like Jordan, it's not when the camera's on, it's before or after. And I think I asked him something as innocuous before we started the interview. I said something like, the Last Dance, you think people are going to love it? At that point, no one had seen it. They wouldn't give me a preview. Like, it was under lock and key. Allegedly, they were still like editing, like, you know, a few nights before it debuted. And I'm thinking, you know, it's MJ. Like, naturally, he's going to say it's going to be the greatest documentary ever. You know, it's going to be amazing. And he didn't. I remember before we started rolling, he said something along the lines of, I don't think it's going to sit well. He was worried about how he was going to be viewed. His chief concern was, keep in mind, the Bulls dynasty, it was the 90s. There was no social media. There wasn't this. He was concerned that people were going to sort of view him through the lens of today, and that maybe people weren't going to be able to fully appreciate what it took to win at that level consistently. He was worried about coming across as a jackass. And you know, I maintain, and my bias notwithstanding, I maintain that it is right now the greatest sports documentary I've ever seen. Now, granted, and I grew up, you know, during that era, but no, it was, that experience is one that I will cherish. And then, to your point, at the end, he's like, hey, you want to have some tequila? I'm like, I'll drink the bottle. And, you know, the problem was it was 9:30 in the morning.
From what I remember, you were a little heavy-handed, though. He called you up for it.
He did. Yeah. That was the hand of a nervous journalist. I was like, I didn't know how much to give him. I wanted to make sure he knew that I was excited. But it was funny because, you know, MJ rolled in with like his family, you know, like his mom was there and his brother was there. And it was funny, his mom, you know, he's introduced me to his family before, and I'm, you know, met his some of his kids were there. And his mom, I kid you not, she said, oh, Matt, you know, she said, Craig, I watch the show. I really enjoy the show every morning. I love that Al Roker. I've been watching Al for you. She's going on and on about America's favorite weatherman. And after the interview was done, I called Roker. I was like, dude, you're not going to believe who's a big fan.
Oh my God. Everyone loves Roker.
Everyone.
People get so starstruck with Al. It's I've seen it so many times.
It's Arthur, it really is a sight to behold, because I've traveled with Roker. I've walked through airports, I've been in, you know, restaurants, bars. It's like you're on tour with Jesus Christ. It really is quite strange. And it, more than anything, it's just a testament to how damn long he's been doing it. Like, it's like Roker will tell, he'll tell stories sometimes. Scratch that. He tells a story every day. that he either has to preface with, this was before you were born, or this is, your parents might remember this, but like a couple of days ago, he's telling some soupy sales story. And I'm like on my phone, Googling like soupy. I was like, oh yes, a 1960s cartoon. That's right. And he tells these stories, and sometimes he'll tell these jokes, and you know, Savannah, Hoda, myself, Carson, we'll kind of have to look at each other and we'll nod or we'll pretend like we know what he's talking about. And then a few minutes later, someone will say, did you catch that one? No,
it's right over my head.
No one knew.
Speaking of catching something, over your left shoulder, there is a football player.
Oh, that's you. Wow, you got a good eye. You got a keen eye. Here, so.
What is...
It's not just one.
How did you spot that, Arthur?
I'm
the king of... Wait, he's got a Mahomes cutout. This is incredible.
So So my son, he's seven now, and he's discovered the joys and wonders of football. I don't know if you can still see it, but yeah, it's right there. And a couple years ago, and I think it's because he kind of looks like maybe Patrick Mahomes would have looked when he was Dell's age, but he, like, out of the blue became a Patrick Mahomes fan. We have no ties to Kansas City. And we're actually kind of Washington football fans. Mom, you know, his mom and I, my wife. And he started, like, really getting into Patrick Mahomes to the point where, like, he insisted on seeing the games every week. And you can't watch Kansas City games here. I don't have, like, DirecTV or Dish or whatever it comes on. NFL Network. So last year, when the pandemic was in full force, we couldn't have a birthday party for him. So we decided to throw a football-themed party, and we invited Patrick Mahomes. And at some point, he also became a fan of Lamar Jackson, who's also deep in the cornerback there. But it's quite odd. It's actually very unusual. A few years ago, I got to spend some time with Mr. Mahomes, but this was before my son was a huge fan. But I'm pleased to report that Patrick Mahomes is also one of those guys who is as kind in person as he appears to be on television.
I want to know where you were when you got the call up. The Today Show is the major leagues. Where were you and what was your reaction when you got that call that you were going to be made anchor?
Oh, that's I remember it vividly, actually. I was here in the basement, and it was New Year's Eve or New Year's Day, and all the years sort of run together now. So this is 2021. This would have been, Liz will have to correct me after the fact, but I think it was 2019. But anyway, the president of our news division called and said, hey, we'd like to put you on Monday through Friday. And I remember thinking, wow. And I tried to play it cool on the phone, and I hung up, and my wife can attest to this. I got emotional, Arthur, because to your point, for people who do what we do, when you go into broadcast journalism,
it's the Yankees.
It's the Yankees. That is an apt comparison. And it's also one of those things where it's funny because, you know, you and I and Matt, we're having this conversation now, and your millions of viewers and readers, they'll watch and read this. But when I started in Columbia, South Carolina, when I was, you know, 22, I wasn't very good. And I didn't think, for a while, I was like, I may just go to law school or grad school because I wasn't convinced early in my career that I was going to make a go of it. And then you do it long enough and you get better at it. And I really started to fall in love with the craft, with doing this, just having conversations with sometimes ordinary people, sometimes extraordinary people, sometimes athletes or actors or presidents. I fell in love with that. And then the pace of the newsroom and all of it. And then just the variety of the stories and not being stuck in an office and not having to do the same thing every day. It was like this constant adrenaline rush. And so when I got the call and I got the offer, it was validation. Because anybody at this level who tells you that they're like, oh yeah, I thought this is how it would work out. They're lying. Like it's years of self-doubt. It's years of doing a lot of stories that you really don't want to do. I covered a lot of car wrecks, a lot of house fires, a lot of robberies because there was cool surveillance video. I did a lot of interviews with the water and sewer commissioner in some obscure town. I did all that for a long time. And I had a handful of folks along the way, a handful, not a lot, who would say, it's going to be worth it. Trust, it's going to be worth it. It's going to be worth it. You're good enough. You're smart enough. Doggone it, you're handsome enough. You know, people who would say all those things. And then after a while, you start to believe it. And also not to get too, you know, I know this isn't a religious podcast, but I am a man of deep faith. And I spent a lot of time not praying for professional success, but praying for being in God's will and wanting to make sure that whatever I was doing, that it was serving some sort of greater purpose. And now for a number of years, I struggled with whether I was actually doing that. And now I feel like on more days than not, I am contributing. That was a really long answer to a really
short question. That was, again, just wind them up and let them go.
But this is why I hate doing these things, because you ask nice, short, pointed questions like a good journalist, and I start bloviating.
No, but it's great because, Okay. Listen, you deal with this as much as we do. The sound bites, it just gets old. And hearing actually these authentic, raw answers is like what I live for. So it's awesome, dude.
Okay. All right. I'm sure I'll get in trouble, but.
Craig, you mentioned, you know, the presidents you've sat down with, Clinton, Biden, you know, Jordan, which I'd put in presidential level. Who was the one subject who you were most nervous to talk to? Or are you such a seasoned pro at this point that nerves don't even play into it?
Presidential interviews always make you nervous. Those are always stressful. I will say I wasn't as nervous as I should have been. I was in local news in Columbia, South Carolina. This was 2007. This may have been early 2008. No, it was early 2008. It was early 2008 because it was ahead of the South Carolina primary. This was maybe January, February of that year. And a buddy of mine had quit his job and he had started working on a campaign for this senator from Illinois. And I remember he called me and he was telling me about this. And I was like, dude, I don't know if that's the best idea. Like, his name's Barack Obama and he's a black guy and he's running for president. I was like, do what you will, you know, it's your life. But if you're asking my opinion, I'd keep the job you have. And so a couple months later, same guy calls me up and he's like, would you like to sit down with the candidate? And at that point, he wasn't the leading candidate. I mean, he was in the race. He picked up some traction And I remember, like, I was doing the interview, and, you know, it was Barack Obama, so it was impressive. Like, you hear everything he's saying, and it's just, you know, glass shatter, all this stuff. Like, I appreciated the history of it, but I remember after the interview, producer said to me, the producer's like, what do you think? I was like, wow, it's impressive, but I mean, his name's Barack Obama. And I think I heard or read that his middle name's Hussein. There's no way he's going to win South Carolina. I'm going on. And I mean, it's just, I am frequently reminded by that friend how wrong I was. I should have been more nervous in that interview. I was not, but no, I get nervous. I get nervous a lot. And the only thing I have found that helps me with the nerves is, and I did this just last week, I guess I was at the White House for a sit down with President Biden. And, you know, it's, I'm in the Roosevelt room and there are all these people around and I'm like, I'm middle school, first dance in the gym, nervous, like that kind of nervous. And, but I can't let it, I can't let on that I'm nervous. So I do this weird thing where I start talking to random people and asking them like stupid questions, like the sound guy, hey, Joe, where are your kids going to college again? Or, you know, there's like some Secret Service guy say, where are you, what part of Wisconsin are you from? How long have you been? How long have you been doing this? You know, and so, and it's, and what you forget is like for interviews like that, like we're piping the sound out to like 30 Rock. So there are 30 people like on these Zooms who can hear all of the ridiculous things you're saying. You know, a couple years ago, I was at the African American History Museum and I had secured the first interview with the new president, President Trump. It was just gonna be what we call a drive-by. He was gonna like walk by and stop. I was the only reporter there. I was just gonna, you know, answer a few questions. And I'm doing that thing I just talked about where I'm just like talking to random people because I'm totally nervous and I can't let on that I'm nervous. And I'm doing that thing and finally, I won't reveal their name, but one of my bosses like calls me on my cell phone and she's like, hey, just so you know, everyone can hear everything you're saying. I'm like, oh my God. Oh my God. And I mean, God only knows at that point what I've been saying. So I learned an important lesson there. Everyone's always listening.
Craig, you've received a few Emmys for your broadcasting work, an AP award, you were named best anchor in South Carolina. What would you say your crowning achievement thus far in broadcasting is?
Oh God, my crowning achievement?
What do you like hold your hat on the most, you know?
I mean, he's gonna have Jordan on his obituary.
Well, I mean, interviews notwithstanding, at this point in my career, I'm proudest of the fact that I haven't been fired. I have managed to hold on to a job longer than I think a lot of folks probably thought I would. Longer than I probably thought I would when I started at 22. No, I think the crowning achievement for us, it's longevity. Like you look at guys like Roker, for instance, guys like Al who have been doing it at this level since probably before you guys were born too. Like that's a feat, especially when you say and do some of the absolutely ridiculous things that he has said and done. And to still be able to show up for work every day and have your card key work. Like that's a crowning accomplishment.
Craig, before we let you go, one of the pillars of this show is to talk to successful people like you and determine how you continue to elevate. So given all the accolades you've earned in your career and personal life, what habits or words to live by do you incorporate in your life to ensure that you continue to elevate?
There are two things that I do every day. Actually, I do one of them every day. I typically rotate. So for instance, this morning, I always start the day in my dressing room engaging in mindfulness. It's not meditation. It's not like, it's none of that. But years ago, I did a story on a guy named Andy Puttacombe who started Headspace. And I started using his app. And I have found it has helped me immensely. Start the day grounded, centered, sort of in not in my head, but alone with my thoughts. That helps. And it's like 10, 15 minutes. That helps me, mindfulness. And the other thing, and this is something that Hoda turned me on to a couple of years ago, and I know it may sound cheesy, but I journal. I'm a big fan of journaling. I can't do it every day because of my schedule sometimes. So I typically try to do it, you know, at least three times a week. So usually it's mindfulness one day, journaling the next, mindfulness journaling. So it's, and I don't typically do it on Sunday. I typically take Saturday or Sunday off, but both of those things. And the journaling for me, and it's not like, I'm not writing three or four pages every day. Sometimes it's just like three paragraphs. And sometimes it's a chronicle of whatever I've done the day before. Sometimes it's funny. Sometimes it's sad. Sometimes it's me just venting about something large or small. But I always end the journaling every day, I always end, and this is, again, this is per Hoda's instructions, I end with something that I'm grateful for. And some days it's something big, like on Monday I journaled that I was grateful because I was going to receive my second shot on Monday. But other days it's, you know, I'm grateful that the kids both slept in their beds that the night before and I was able to get 6 or 7 hours. But it forces you to start the day in a place of gratitude versus starting the day with a chip on your shoulder, starting the day with, oh, I got to do this. Oh, I didn't get to do this. Oh, it's so you start the day up versus starting the day, man, if that makes any sense.
Yes. One more thing before you go, Craig, can we just talk about how awesome Will Smith is with his Instagram posts? Like, if you couldn't love that guy anymore, he just made himself even more lovable.
He did. But here's the thing, Arthur, like I saw Will Smith's like pandemic dad bod. I was like, That's like my bod 6 years ago when I was in shape, you know, like it was like, oh, I'm so fat. I've let myself go so much. Like, you snot. And here's the other thing. Yeah. Okay. Maybe he's put on a few LBs. It was the shorts. That's what really sort of made it worse than I think it probably seemed. Like, you can't wear shorts like that. I don't care if you're Will Smith or Arthur Matt or Craig, those aren't shorts that a grown man should be wearing outside his bedroom.
Only maybe. Will Smith. If anyone can get away with anything, it's Will Smith. That guy's got so much goodwill currency built up. He's just the king.
Agree.
Craig, congrats on the new book, man. Really great stuff. As someone who didn't have a close relationship with his own father, now he's my best friend. To be able to relate to your story, I'm sure there's millions of us out there. It's just really cool stuff you were able to share, man.
Well, Arthur and Matt, I hope that that's one of the reasons I wrote it for folks who've had those difficult relationships with their dad or their mom. But you know, you should never write someone off. You should never give up on anyone because that's where we were. And you know, my dad in his late 60s started living a new life, and if he can do it, anybody can do it. And if ours is a relationship that can be repaired, any relationship can be repaired.
Pops, my father, our journey, and what I'm still learning about being a dad from the charismatic Craig Melvin. Thank you for joining the show. You're welcome back anytime.
Thank you, guys. I enjoyed this.
All right, folks. That was, of course, today's show host, Craig Melvin. Make sure to pick up his new book, Pops, Learning to Be a Son and a Father. It's available in bookstores and anywhere you buy books now. Our final interview is one of my favorite current bands and a bunch of young fellas who really take me back to the type of rock and roll that I grew up with. After they came out of the gates, Greta Van Fleet absolutely lit the world on fire. We're able to perform on SNL. They win a Grammy. They're just crushing it. We're back with a brand new album. It's called The Battle at Garden's Gate. They've developed an incredible fan following. And I was able to chat with Jake and Sam from the group. Incredible chat, by the way, just talking about their career, the Led Zeppelin comparisons, their philosophy and theories on music, where they want to be. These guys are nothing if not a throwback. And I think you guys are going to really enjoy this chat. So here are Jake and Sam from Greta Van Fleet. All right, it is a big day on Bro Bible's Endless Hustle as I'm joined by Jake and Sam from one of my favorite bands, if not my favorite current band, Greta Van Fleet, brand new album, The Battle at Garden's Gate. You guys are in a great mood too. I fucking love it.
Well, not always, but today is a very special day. Sam, do you want to tell Arthur what today is?
Yes.
Today is the day, 2 days after Cinco de Mayo,
and we're still hungover.
That's right. So wait, that's what today is. That's why we're in such a good mood.
Forget the album promotion. Tell me about what you guys did Cinco de Mayo. Oh,
well, we hung out with our good friend, yeah. Marcus King.
Comrade.
And he invited all the musicians he knows in Nashville. And we jammed until, you know, the sun was coming up. Then we threw some cakes on the griddle and passed out.
That's right.
Wait a minute. I'm going to be in Nashville over Memorial Day weekend. I feel like I've got to seek you guys out and just do this partying thing with you.
Yeah, we're going to be riding the party tractor downtown.
Yep. We'll be driving it.
You're serious right now.
Yeah, we actually signed up. We actually got a specialized license for it.
Yeah, we did. Yeah.
So now we can technically fly small aircraft as well.
Yep, and small trailer and truck vehicles.
I mean, after spending the first 30 seconds with you, I don't know if that's such a good idea for Nashville. I'm actually somewhat concerned. All right. So congrats, new album. Here's why I love you guys so much. I'm going to be 43 and holy shit, it's like 10 days now.
Goodness.
I grew up with 70s rock. You guys are one of the few bands that I actually consider rock and roll today because the rest of it is some weird non-instrumental music. So I freaking love it that you guys kind of pay homage to what I grew up with. How did that all start for you guys?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think a lot of our sound is sort of influenced and a proponent of what we grew up with in a certain sense. So I think a lot of instrumental driven rock and roll was sort of part of the threshold of that. I think, you know, one thing to say that's very interesting is that especially because of when we really first got together and started playing, we were extremely, extremely young. So anything that we were trying to craft, most musicians get together later in life and they go, this is kind of the sound we want to try to create. This is sort of, you know, I'm seeking certain individual musicians out that could help craft a sound, but we had no relation to be able to do that at this age. So when we got together, Sam was maybe 16, Daniel as well, and Josh and I were like early high school. It just sounded the way it did, and we kicked it off. And since then, we really haven't looked back necessarily, but it kind of came together quite, you know, organically to a certain degree.
You guys are from the middle of nowhere, little town in Detroit, where literally you're playing probably to like six people. So when you're first starting out, like, what's that process like? How do you even get discovered? How do you get a label to notice you?
I guess we never really paid attention to that. We just played, and we played out as much as we can also, mostly because that's just what we wanted to do. We're just following our muse, crafting our songs at home and jamming through hours and hours of Cream and original compositions, and then going out and see how much time we could fill.
So then, like, how do you get the heck out of Detroit or right outside Detroit? How does a label even notice you guys?
Well, it was really interesting, I suppose. We were recording in Detroit a lot at a small studio called Rust Belt. And it was interesting. We had one showcase in Nashville. We were working with Al Sutton and Marlon Young and Herschel Boone, some of the guys from the Kid Rock camp. And we were doing some recording there. And so Al Sutton, the producer, his entertainment lawyer set up some, you know, showcase down here in Nashville. And we came down to play, and it's interesting. The person who we showcased for, I don't think was particularly interested. The entertainment lawyer that Al had brought in a manager. And we kind of clicked instantly with this guy. And from there, it kind of just progressively, you know, spiraled. And the label, where it was interested, I suppose we had Highway Tune and all of those earlier songs on the first EP. And we sent them to Jason Flom at Republic. And he said, I'm going to sign these guys without, you know, we didn't see us play. He just signed us on the spot.
So I guess this is a testament to rock and roll.
I guess so. I think it lives.
I love your vibe, guys. I got to tell you, like, you do remind me of what I grew up with. And I've gotten to interview everybody in music, and you can kind of tell who are more the performers and more kind of the manufactured products and who are kind of the real deal. And I'm getting the real deal vibe with you, which I totally fucking dig, which is great.
We appreciate that, yes, Arthur. It's nice to know that we exude that energy.
It is refreshing.
You do. You have a 70s feel to you, and that's the biggest compliment I can give you. But you know what's also cool is you have immediate success, the Grammy nominations, all, like, that's not the normal thing. You realize that, right? So when it's happening, what's going through your head?
It's interesting because, again, that's if you could have walked into the garage that we used to rehearse in four years ago and would have told us what we were going to, what we'd be experiencing now, 4 years later, I don't think any of us would have believed it. A single word that anybody would have said. It was like, you know, I suppose that's something that you can't plan for, but I think that's what sort of on the helms of all these sort of mistakes and all these sort of, you know, things that come to pass in their career, it was something that we didn't expect, something that we certainly weren't pining for, but like, it was like, I remember waking up in LA one day and getting a call and said, hey, you're nominated for 4 Grammys. And that's like, you know, it was pretty elating. I mean, it's not something that you can plan for, but it just happened. It was pretty exciting.
Yeah, I think it's overall following truly what you believe in along the way, and good things will come. I suppose he who seeks out the personal legend of their own lives is helped by the universe.
I think so. It's also interesting to note as well that, you know, contemporary rock and roll can be so successful in the contemporary world. It's very interesting, the evolution of rock and roll in that sense, that a rock and roll band could be nominated for 4 Grammys in 2019 or something, you know?
So when you guys show up to the Grammys, you're kind of an unknown still. What is that experience like for you? Do people already, like, is an A-list music artist approaching you guys? Are you totally unknown? What is it like?
No, I think that most people in the industry know Greta Van Fleet, just because it's fairly anomalous in the recent history of the music industry. So yeah, a lot of people were kind of coming up to us, and we invited Jason Flom and we invited Mark Geiger from our booking agency, William Morris. And so yeah, a lot of people were coming up, like Chad Smith came up to say hi.
Yeah, that's right.
But yeah, that was a blur. You had to pregame because they don't let you bring in alcohol, because there's a lot of people with, you know, drinking problems there.
Yeah, lots of drinking. It's a gathering space of AA people. It's like, you know, come to the Grammys.
And that's real, by the way.
Yeah,
that's,
they don't sell alcohol there.
I mean, as I'm talking to you guys, I really do think I want to find you guys in Nashville when I'm there over Memorial Day weekend. I think I'm going to have the best time with you guys.
I think we can revise this whole Grammy thing.
We're hard to miss.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll see you. We'll see you when you're down here.
Another thing you got to experience was SNL. That's like, I mean, if I was a band or a musical artist, that's probably number one on my list. What's that first SNL experience like for you guys?
I mean, I suppose, especially because we've been watching SNL since we were kids, and our grandmother played all of the original SNLs, and we'd watch them every weekend as they came on. Something that you gain out of the experience that's invaluable, it's interesting to be standing on the stage that you've watched so many great musicians pass through. There's sort of a lineage, and I think, you know, when you walk out of that building having performed there, it's sort of now you sort of are a part of the lineage, and you feel kind of a familial sense of, you know, being there. And it was interesting too, because when we got off the stage, it was like, you know, you're seeing all these other faces as well, and people are coming up to you and shaking your hand and saying, you know, I love your music or something. And you have Alec Baldwin, you know, it's like, he walked by and he's like, hey boys, love your music. So that was another, you know, sort of thing that was, you know, completely unexpected, but
right. And Lorne Michaels, you know, took the time to have some words with us, which I think was really special.
He said, we'll be seeing you again as well, you know, so.
But it was a very sweet, it was kind of an instant nostalgic experience, because you're kind of looking backward and you're at a certain place, but you're also looking ahead. So it's pretty crazy. And I think SNL is probably the only truly live show, late night show.
That right? lives contemporarily.
It's actually 100% live.
Yeah.
So that was a bit intimidating. But yeah, it was an amazing experience, especially there at the end where we're kind of standing there. And
yeah.
And it's like, you know, just you're supposed to talk and, you know. Have
like,
a good time.
Just talk, and we're like talking to Alec, and we're like, what do we do? He's like, I don't know, just fucking talk.
And he's like, just stand there and look
that's
pretty.
That's what we do, just stand there and look pretty.
I mean, if you're going to ask someone for SNL advice, there's no one better to ask than Alec Baldwin.
It was pretty good. It was an amazing experience.
So the million-dollar question is, what's the after party like? I've heard all the legendary stories from different artists. What was your experience like?
We're contractually obligated not to tell you.
No, yeah, you know it's all union, right?
It's all union.
So it was that good is what you're telling me. Better than Cinco de Mayo, I'm guessing.
It was better than Cinco de Mayo, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah, it was, except we had to get on a bus and fly to Japan.
That's the only next difference. Morning. That's the only difference.
That's the biggest difference.
That's a big difference.
How the heck did you make that? You're going straight to the airplane, no sleep, I'm guessing.
Yeah, that is completely true. Because we did a family vacation before that, which we were very dead set on doing, because our mom would have been pissed at us because she kept pushing it. And so
that's dish loading job for eternity, pissed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so then we just made time for SNL and shot over to Japan and Australia. And then we got back to the United States just in time for the Grammys.
That's right. I landed in LA.
What an absolute run for you guys. It's incredible. So now you have this new album. It's getting rave reviews. People love it again. Is there nerves going into the new album? Are you like, shit, we've had so much success. What if we bomb this one?
I think it's interesting. I think in terms of any pressure that we sort of felt during the duration of the second album process was sort of self-inflicted, I think. I don't think that, and again, it's to say that we don't really take external criticism in a way or incorporate things that other people are saying. We've always been sort of true to the art that we want to create. So I think the pressure really was coming in from the interior of the group. We're all kind of looking at each other going, we need to capture this performance that we've never captured before. We need to write songs better than we've written them in the past, constructively, instrumentally. We're looking at the lyrical aspects. We're pretty much everything that we've kind of done over the last 3 years of touring and incorporating that. I think the objective really was to try to beat what we've done before in the past. And I think we achieved that.
How do you measure success for something like this? Is it album sales? Is it Grammy nods? Like, what's the level of success for you guys?
It's all about the money.
Very important.
What I think is most important about it is seeing the actual reaction and the way that fans will hold the music to their heart. And like, for example, seeing people with a tattoo of a song, because it means that much to them, that they connected with it and it meant something in their life. When we started out, I feel like we were primarily making the music completely for ourselves. And as time went on, I think more and more we're understanding that the listener is the one who determines the meaning and the one who decides what the song is about to them. And that's why we make music.
Yeah, I think if we look at ourselves as a group, I mean, I think we're a band for the people. And I think that all the music that we write and everything that we sort of do is to serve them in a way. So to see their reactions be very positive in a sense, that's you know, I think that's really fulfilling for us.
It's all about pumping that energy out into the world, I think.
See, that is such a great musician answer. I would have stayed with, it's all about the money. That's why I need to be a music artist and be like, I'm getting paid, folks. How about in Detroit? Did you guys grow up sports fans at all? Did you like the Red Wings, the Lions, anybody?
We pretend like we do, but no, not really.
We try.
Daniel definitely was. Daniel was in Detroit seeing Lions games. And
we went to a Lions game when we were kids once, perhaps. And then what was it? What was it? Baseball? Maybe it was.
We were always kind of more into like the Iditarod, you know, like dog sled races across.
We were raised Alaska. In a very avant-garde sort of fashion.
I've been doing this for a decade, guys. I think this is the first time anyone's mentioned dog sled races.
Yeah, the Iditarod.
sailboat racing. Our father has been on a few excursions with our uncle. You know, racing from like Chicago to Mackinac Island.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Ice climbing. That was sort of the sport.
Death sports.
Death sports. We did a lot of death sports. We were profound skiers. And I know that we grew up skiing.
we're little known fact. We're winter animals for certain. But yeah, most of the time, I think that all of our buddies were in sports and interested in basketball, baseball, football, what have you. But we were just playing music, and that was kind of our sport.
So what's been your most rock star moment right now? Like the craziest thing that's happened so far to you guys in your career?
This is it.
This is it. Talking to you, Arthur.
Arthur, this is it.
I love it. I wish that was the case. I know there's definitely some cool stuff you've experienced.
Yeah, there's some stuff that we actually can't talk about.
I think one of the cool, I think one of the most elaborate moments you maybe was meeting Elton John, I think still, because he a profound influence and someone of great legacy. And there are very few people I think that would, shake me walking into a room, and Elton John is certainly one of them. And that was we were honored by that whole experience. I think for me, that I think maybe the greatest rock star moment.
It's pretty rock and roll.
Yeah,
it's none more rock and roll.
None more.
How does he react when he meets you guys? Did he know who you were? Like, what's the reaction?
Very casual. He just said, "Hi, I'm Elton."
Yeah, he's like,
gives a handshake, a little hug.
Yeah.
Say, because we were doing a show with him at his AIDS Foundation fundraiser.
Yeah.
And we played one of our songs and one of his songs, "You're the One" and "Saturday Night's All Right."
Yeah, I remember he just said, like, this is for fun. I mean, it could be an amazing performance, or it could be a train wreck. He's like, that's cool too. I enjoy that as well.
You can't screw up in front of Elton John.
If
you're going to screw up, that's not the dude to screw up in front of.
Yeah.
Truth.
It's true.
When you look at today's artists, who are the musical influences that the next two generations should be looking at?
That's interesting. There are so many. I think this is, we're on the heels of a new generation sort of taking music and evolving it in very different ways.
That's incredibly difficult to say.
It is. I mean, it's, to name some of the folks, the individuals that we've toured with, Ida Mae is a prolific group. Aaron Lee Tashjian is fantastic. Yola is brilliant.
I would have to say Marcus King also.
Marcus King is what I was going to mention, yeah. Marcus King for certain. Goodbye June is another fantastic group. But there are so many to name. It's very difficult. It's very difficult.
Yeah, I think it's just generationally speaking, creating kind of a web of attitude and kind of what means what to our generation. And I still think it's being developed. I mean, Generation Z we're just kind of coming up right now.
I think, there's a lot of development in the process currently.
Most of us haven't even graduated college yet.
The thing that's cool about you guys is you're actually very talented instrumentalists. And when I see some of these kids on TikTok and they can't even carry a tune and they're already making millions of dollars, I'm just like, what is happening with the world? What's your feelings when you see social media stars who don't necessarily potentially have talent, but are exploding? It's got to drive you nuts.
I don't think we really care, because we know that it's kind of one of those situations where history will find them very easy to forget.
It's particle board,
Yeah, it's not built to last. It could.
There's
more power to them.
But I think that's great. I think many people have said that rock and roll is dead. And I don't mean to be political, but maybe TikTok would be the death of rock and roll.
If you want to peg it,
if you really want to know. Well, ask Gene Simmons what he thinks about TikTok.
Yeah, and also I think that we're looking at a lot of extremes in our world right now. Over the past 4 or 5 years, we look at two very separate sides of culture, especially in America. And we look at the very rich and the very poor, and we're also looking at people who...
There's very little intermediate there.
Yeah, exactly. And, the middle class is dying, and I think that also goes for art. I think that there's very mainstream art, and there's very
successful art.
Right, and that makes a lot of money. And there's the best art that's being made. The realest shit is so undiscovered.
Yeah.
But it's out there. It exists.
I think that's a good... blanket statement answering the question. Ground zero stuff, especially in East Nashville, it's pretty crazy counterculture going on right now.
That's why we moved there.
And no, it's incredible. I talked to all the country stars. Like, we just had Dustin Lynch on, we had Brett Young, who else? Russell Dickerson. What's happening in Nashville? It is Music City USA now. And the fact that you guys are not even a country band and you're there just shows what's happening. They have a, it's really what Detroit used to be when I was growing up, you know, actually even before me with, you know, the Motown sound. That's now Nashville.
Yeah, it's pretty wild.
Yeah, it's all happening here.
Yeah, it's great that that's why we moved. It's you can feel the sort of energy, the sparks that are in the air. Something exciting, and I suppose what's to come out of Nashville in the next decade is going to be very interesting.
Who were your influences growing up? Obviously, there have been the gazillion Zeppelin impressions, which I think is, by the way, the greatest compliment you can ever receive because they were the best. But who were your influences?
Well, I think it's interesting. We were sort of raised, I guess, the music that we were surrounded by at such an early age was pretty rudimentary stuff. So a lot of our early influences sort of were stemmed from blues. See, like Lightnin' Hopkins, Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, Albert King, you know, all the Kings, Buddy Guy, B.B. King, you know, like everyone, John Lee Hooker, another Detroit guy. So tons and tons of blues were sort of the was sort of the core value of what we sort of came from. So I think that that's important to sort of note, that we really didn't start listening to rock and roll as, you know, I think culture fundamentally views it until we were probably into high school, and our background was really early roots blues music. That's kind of a lot of those guys who were influential to us, I think, overall.
And like you were saying, I think it was a lot of Motown music as well. A lot of soul, funk, R&B kind of stuff.
Yeah, folk. Yeah, but all kind of roots stuff, you know?
Where do you guys like want to be 10 years from now? What's kind of the path? And I know the cliche answer is we'll pretty much see, but what in your minds, if you were to track it out, where do you guys want to see yourself 10, 15 years from now?
I think that our objective as a group is sort of to touch people and to move people, whether they're extraordinarily pissed off or extraordinarily affected at peaceful ends, because that's what art is. It's to affect people. So the more people we can reach, I think the happier we'll be, I think.
Yeah, and I would be somewhat surprised if Greta Van Fleet is still a functioning band in 10 years. And it's not morbid to say, I think it's just a natural part of the process.
That's a fascinating statement. Why do you say that? Is it just that tough to keep a band together in this day and age, or any day and age?
I think that the way we work is sometimes violent, and we're all very opinionated, and we all have our very different opinions about some things sometimes.
I think that, yeah, once we've come to achieve what we set out to achieve and to affect the world and put the albums out that we wanted to effectively, then perhaps we'll go into something else.
Oh, maybe we'll start a different project.
Yeah.
I mean, listen, I'm as type A as it gets. So how do you guys manage the egos in the process? Because everybody's got to have a creative gene and everybody's got to really want to create. How are you able to manage it at this point?
It's interesting. I certainly think that being bound by blood has some effect to that, to, you know, a certain degree, you know, that because we've grown up in a household listening to very similar influences with similar ideas. You know, we're raised under the flagship of a certain philosophy. And I think that that certainly helps us communicate to a certain degree and allow, you know, there's this give and take, bend but don't break. That's sort of the idea. And I think that we got a lot of that out early on. I don't know. There's a certain democracy about what we do.
Yeah. There's a function to the way that the band works.
And I think chaos is good. I think chaos is influential. As you know, and I think we've been successful with, you know, the balancing chaos with, you know, peace in the room and actually ending up with exactly musically what we want. So there's some sort of a, you know, amalgamated process there. I don't know.
It makes great art.
So Sam, here's the $1 million question. How many times a day do you get told you look like Timothy Chalamet?
I don't think I've ever ever. No, never.
That's interesting. Yeah. You do slightly resemble him a bit.
Who?
Oh my God, I think he looks just like him.
Let me look this up.
You don't know who Timothée Chalamet is? He's an A-list actor.
No, never
he's
heard
like
of
our
him.
Age. He's like our gen.
Timothy.
Hey. He's looking him up.
Timothy.
Timothée Chalamet. Do you see it? The guy's like the biggest heartthrob for Gen Z on the planet right now.
Timothy Chalamet.
I see. Wow, yeah. Well, see, he has a thinner jawline than I.
He's got like the movie star jawline, but the resemblance is there.
I see it. I would take that as a compliment. Is he older than me?
I don't know. Chalamet's like early 20s.
Oh, he's 14.
Dude, he's like the biggest movie star on the planet right now.
He's older than Josh and Jake.
He's a legit this generation's Leo. Like, no joke. Like, he's going to win like a bunch of Oscars. He's already been nominated. Like, it's insanity what's happening for that kid.
I've seen he did The King. I saw The King. That was a good film.
Yep, and
shit, here comes the train.
That's the tequila train. Oh, well.
I was wondering whose end that was on. My internet's shit. Meanwhile, you guys are near a train station. By the way, I had no idea how you guys had come up with the title of the band. And then I read the whole amalgamation of the lady's name. Has she ever reached out to you guys? Like, has there ever been, or anybody from the family? Like, did they figure it out? Like, what happens?
They reached out already. It's interesting. It's interesting because even early on, I think Gretna actually came to one of the shows we played at Fisher Hall, small venues. Like, it's like our, you know, town of 5,000, like communal sort of space with a stage. And she came with her husband and she sat through maybe a 3-hour, you know, rock and roll show. They were blasting volume out and she stuck around through the entire thing, actually enjoyed it, came up, met us backstage.
At least she said she enjoyed it.
She said it. Yeah, that's it. That's a disclaimer.
Yeah, went up on stage, took some photographs, and that was kind of the passing of the torch, I suppose.
Yeah, we've seen her. She comes to like Michigan shows too. I think the next time we played the Fox Theater, she was at those two shows. And
we give her the star treatment.
We do.
I'm surprised you haven't gotten either a cease and desist order or a request for some kind of residuals.
Yeah, well, we took the N out, so it's, you know,
it's just Greta.
It's just Greta.
Totally different.
What about the name of the album? Like, how do you come up with this name? Because it's so random. So, like, how does that discussion happen?
The Battle at Garden's Gate. Well, I think, I know that Josh came up with this concept of the Battle at Garden's Gate about halfway through recording the album, and we started to find its meaning.
Yeah, it was really interesting. I think that we had no preconceptions of, like, you know, what we would call the album. We were just writing the music and recording the album. And as soon as we kind of, I think, became more aware consciously of what stories we were trying to tell lyrically and instrumentally, that this sort of became a story, a film, a plot line, in an almost biblical way. And so I think it was essential at that point that we kind of came up with something that could be of a title, like, you know, of a movie title or a novel title. And Josh, you know, came up with the Battle at Garden's Gate, and I don't think we had any hesitation. I think we were all, you know, convinced at that point that that was the best name for what we were creating in that moment.
Do you know when a song is good or when music is good? So if you guys are in the studio and just messing around, if something's getting played, are you like, all right, that's good?
I think we more so know when something is shit than it's good, perhaps. But
if it's not shit, it could be good.
It could be good, and we'll entertain it.
I've always wondered that. If I was an artist, I'd be like, am I really making this or is it shit? You know, I'm so curious.
It crosses the mind all the time.
It does.
All right. So I want to talk to you about nutrition for a second. Walk me through what you guys do nutrition-wise to stay healthy and what your diet looks like on the road.
Well, that is extremely difficult because the only after-show food you can usually get lives in the realm of pizza.
Well, we were just talking about good music and bad music. This would be shit music after food. It's terrible. Yes.
So it is very difficult to maintain, you know, a proper functioning body.
Yeah, it is a struggle. But I think with catering, most of the time, it's like you can wake up and there's plenty of, you know, I don't know, there's plenty of like, you know, clean foods. There's like rice and vegetables and protein and, you know, I think it's pretty good. I mean, we get one good meal during the day, and I think even performing is quite the workout in itself. Is
you have to eat at the proper time. You can't eat too soon, or you can't eat too late, because right. Either you'll be hungry or sluggish.
Yeah, so it's fine line. It's a balance. I don't know. We always come back off tour having lost like 5, 6, 7 pounds or something.
Is it an important facet though? Do you think about nutrition and working out while you're on the road?
Not really.
No, I don't think so.
That's a hell of an answer. All right, my final question for you guys: what do you do to elevate in your careers?
I think we're all extremely hard on ourselves. I can't say that it's healthy all the time, but we kind of just hold ourselves to extremely high standards. Whether we're making unrealistic goals or not, it's certainly something that happens.
Yeah, I think in all senses, like I'm talking about elevation interpersonally, existentially, spiritually, musically, the bound function of our human sort of operation. It's interesting. It's different for everybody, but I think what sort of elevates us in a way is just the ability to be truly free as a musician, to create music that we want to create and put into the world to affect people. And I think this, if we can sort of oblige this concept and look at it like at the core, I think what really elevates us is the fact that we in this lifetime do something that we love. We're not working for someone, we're working towards something. And I think, you know, we absolutely love creating music that touches people, and people can feel that love as well. So I think that's certainly something that, you know, gets us off.
That's a great answer. I had no idea what to expect with you guys, and musicians can be so hit or miss personality wise. You guys are an A+, man. Thanks for a fun interview. Congrats on the brand new album. Go get a bunch of Grammy nominations and then let's go party in Nashville.
Let's do it. Sounds like a deal to me, also. Yeah.
And remember, say you're Timothy Chalamet. See what happens. Greta Van Fleet's popular, but Timothy Chalamet, whole different level, guys.
Movie star.
Guys, thanks for a blast. This was awesome.
Likewise. Good time, yeah. Arthur.
All right, that was, of course, Greta Van Fleet. Boy, Jake and Sam are something. Love chatting with those two guys. And again, please support the band. Their new album is called The Battle at Garden's Gate. I freaking loved it, so go buy it. If I'm telling you to buy it, then buy it. That's it for another incredible triple header on Endless Hustle. As always, subscribe, rate, communicate, love us. You know the deal. Follow us on social media. On Twitter, we are at @endless_hustle. On Instagram, @endlesshustlepod. I'm on social media as well. I'm @ArthurCade on Twitter. @itsmeArthurCade on Instagram. So please follow all of us and tell us to say hello and you love our interviews. Anyway, thanks as always for supporting Endless Hustlers. We'll see you on Thursday.